From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be taking a look at homelessness in the United States. Every year, at least 3.5 million Americans spend at least part of the year without a home. These individuals are deprived of basic necessities most of us take for granted, including sanitation, access to safe water, decent nutrition, transportation, and protection from violence and from exposure to the elements. Two experts on the impacts of homelessness on health are joining us today, James O'Connell and Jeff Singer. And we'll be discussing some of the major health problems the homeless population faces, and the efforts many healthcare workers are making to provide medical services to this most vulnerable population. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today's news report has been compiled and edited by Andy Coates and Elaine Hills. The United States Supreme Court ruled unanimously on June 11th that home health care workers are not entitled to minimum wages or overtime pay. In 1974, Congress amended a piece of New Deal legislation, the Fair Labor Standards Act, to put home health workers in a category with babysitters, defining their role as providing, quote, companionship services. After over 20 years of providing home health care services, Evelyn Koch, a Jamaican immigrant who works 70 hours a week without overtime pay, including frequent 24-hour shifts, sued her employer, seeking overtime compensation, and ultimately lost her case before the Supreme Court. There are 1.4 million home health care workers in the U.S., typically single mothers between the ages of 25 and 54. According to a year 2002 article in the American Journal of Public Health, over a third of home health care workers have no form of health insurance themselves. And with the recent Supreme Court ruling, little help is in sight for this large group of health care workers that might allow more of them to rise above poverty-level compensation levels. Iraq has reported 5 cases of cholera among children in the past 3 weeks, according to UNICEF. All of the cases were among children under age 12 in the southern city of Najaf. Cholera spreads through bacteria and contaminated water and is easily treatable with modern medical equipment. But untreated, it brings death through dehydration. Although none of these cases were fatal, public health officials have greeted this news as ominous, for only 17% of Iraqis currently have access to clean drinking water, according to the United Nations. A $10 billion industry in the U.S., bottled water is both a big moneymaker and an environmental disaster. More than 1 billion people worldwide lack access to clean drinking water, yet the bottled water business is booming, according to a new vital signs update from the World Watch Institute. Industrial bottling of water hurts local streams and groundwater and requires millions of tons of plastic water bottles. These bottles are mostly made of polyethylene terephthalate, which takes up to 1,000 years to biodegrade. And 9 of 10 water bottles used in the U.S. ends up in landfills. About 2 million tons went to American landfills in the year 2005. The World Watch Institute also reports that the retail cost of bottled water in the U.S. is about 1,000 times higher than the price of tap water. According to data compiled by the Guttmacher Institute, the state-by-state struggle over abortion rights continues in the U.S. This year, 24 abortion ban bills have been introduced in 16 state legislatures. Mississippi was the only state to enact such a law, a ban on abortion in the event Roe v. Wade is overturned. comparable legislation was defeated in Utah. Efforts to outlaw abortion outright were defeated in Mississippi and also in South Dakota. Abortion bans remain under active consideration in 9 other states. Meanwhile, legislators in Rhode Island have introduced 2 measures aimed at protecting a woman's right to abortion, and this would be similar to laws that are in place in 7 other states. Details can be found online at the Guttmacher Institute website, guttmacher.org. That's Guttmacher. Coming up next, a look at the impacts of homelessness on health here in the U.S. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. On any given day, approximately 850,000 Americans find themselves with no home. Some are men, some are women, nearly 95,000 are children. Many suffer from mental illness and physical abuse, and a large number harbor communicable illnesses such as HIV and tuberculosis. No population in the United States suffers from poorer health than the homeless population. Their average life expectancy is 30 years shorter than the U.S. mean, comparable to the poorest countries in the world. At least 70% have no form of health insurance. Most have no reliable form of transportation and can't afford and have no way to prepare a healthy diet. Sanitation is impossible, and in many municipalities, anti-loitering statutes define their homeless existence as a crime. On today's show, we'll speak with 2 individuals who have devoted their careers to understanding the problems of the homeless and providing medical and mental health care to them. Jeff Singer is the president and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless of Maryland, and president of the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, the organization which represents 187 homeless healthcare agencies throughout the U.S. Singer is a clinical social worker and has done street outreach and community organizing since 1969. After completing his training in medicine at Mass General Hospital in 1985, our other guest, Jim O'Connell, became the founding physician of the Boston Healthcare for the Homeless program, and has served as its president for over 10 years. 3 years after its founding, the project was accepted among the first group of federally funded homeless health care delivery programs. O'Connell has overseen the development of a citywide service delivery network that has emerged as a national model. Multidisciplinary teams conduct daily clinics at academic medical centers and provide care to the homeless at over 70 sites in metropolitan Boston, including homeless shelters, soup kitchen, transitional programs, detox units, a local thoroughbred racetrack, and directly on the streets. Throughout the entire 22 years in the project, O'Connell has juggled an active role in the strategic direction of the program with direct clinical work as an internist providing patient care to Boston's homeless population. Jim O'Connell and Jeff Singer, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Even though I personally have never worked in a homeless healthcare project, I can tell you that many patients of mine who have families and have been in, you'd call them middle class, have things have happened that they didn't want to have happen, and they've ended up homeless. But on the other hand, I know that there are people who are severely alcoholic or mentally ill who are always homeless. So I guess what I'm getting at is, are there subgroups, are there different populations of individuals who become homeless at various points in their lives?
Marvin, I think that the answer to that is a complicated one. I tend to view homelessness as a prism that reflects virtually every sector of our society. And the people who experience homelessness are a wide cross-section of society. So it is children, adolescents, there are young men struggling without work, there are older folks who have gone to the streets for a variety of reasons, and then you have people with all sorts of disabilities who become homeless often because of the disability. There's people who are living with AIDS, there's people with chronic medical and mental health conditions. And so when you start to look at who is homeless, you start to see a broad cross-section of our society.
But there would be groups that are more likely to be homeless. For example, are more of them male than female? And you mentioned that there are children who are homeless, which, when you think about it, must just be devastating. And when you think of what it takes to raise a child, not even having a home would be an obstacle to almost everything you want to do to raise a child in a safe and secure and protected way. So can you describe some of these groups in more detail?
When we ask percentages of the homeless population, it always depends on where you put your focus. So for example, when you ask about family homelessness, certainly in Boston, and I think reflected throughout the country, you will see way more women than men, usually mothers, single mothers with children. But when you look at adult homelessness across the country, you tend to find anywhere from 3 men to every woman to 5 men to every woman. So the demographics tend to vary depending on which subgroup of the homeless population you look at.
Maybe now we can turn to the health of people who are homeless. And Jim, I know that you have done studies of mortality among homeless individuals in various parts of the U.S. I was wondering if you could maybe start us off on that issue. What do homeless people die of, and does it seem like they're dying at younger ages?
I would certainly start by saying we're learning to our horror that homelessness really results in horrible, horrible health outcomes. And perhaps the most studied outcome is mortality. And we've looked at studies that have been conducted in cities throughout the world, in Australia, Sweden, France, and in several cities across America. And in general, homeless people of any age die at about 4 times the rate of a similar person who's housed in that particular city. So in our gross estimate, just being homeless confers a 4-fold mortality rate on people experiencing it. However, when we look at certain subsegments of the population, and what I think we have become more and more focused upon in the past few years in urban America are the folks who live chronically on the streets. And we're learning that while their average age is like other adult homelessness, somewhere in the mid-40s, their mortality rates approach 30 to 40% over a 5-year period, which we are now learning is perhaps the worst mortality rate we know of any subpopulation in America. And this means that people are dying in their late 40s, which if you look at the usual American life expectancy of for men into the late 70s, this means that homelessness is actually causing people to lose 30 to 40 years of their life.
That would be on a par with some of the poorest countries in the world.
We've been trying to investigate that, but it's on a par, if not even worse, certainly most all European countries, but it looks like a very third world country figure.
Reading your study, it looked like the profile of what people who are homeless are dying of is somewhat different than the general population, which is hardly surprising. And I was wondering if you could describe some of that.
There have been surprising things that we've learned. What we're finding is we look at what are the causes of death. What we are finding is that it's primarily medical causes. People are dying not as we thought from exposure or things that we worry about a lot, but they're dying of cancer. They're dying of cardiac disease. They're dying of chronic lung problems, chronic liver disease, and kidney problems. So as we begin to look at the profile, what we're suspecting is that homeless people are suffering from very debilitating chronic medical illnesses in the setting of no safe place to heal, recover, often struggling with mental or substance abuse illnesses, and they simply can't cope with those chronic medical illnesses. And we're slowly learning now that the thing we worry about most is when someone we are caring for has the burden of a chronic medical illness plus a mental health problem, those people suffer a very high mortality rate.
Homeless folk die of these chronic illnesses more frequently because they don't have access to 2 very important resources, and one of them is health care and health insurance. and the other is housing. Any illness is more treatable when people have a permanent and stable place to live. We also know that there's a deleterious effect of not having health insurance.
The U.S. stands alone as the only developed country that doesn't provide insurance to our entire population. We have 47 million or more people without health insurance. So does this go better in other countries? Or how does homelessness in the United States compare to other developed countries?
Homelessness, while it is found in other developed countries, it's much more prevalent in this one. Not only is this the only advanced industrial country that doesn't provide health insurance to folks, and we know, by the way, that lack of health insurance and these chronic medical conditions are not only a result of homelessness, but a cause of homelessness. I can tell you so many stories of people that we see who were employed and there was an illness either themselves or in their family, and they became bankrupt. 50% of the bankruptcies in the United States are caused by medical bills that can't be paid. It's the single most prominent cause of bankruptcy. But we have a lot of experience with homelessness being caused by health problems, and then so much harder to treat those problems when people are living on the streets or in shelters.
I'd like to begin to talk about the approaches toward treating individuals who are homeless. And you've mentioned several times that medical illness among individuals who are homeless goes untreated and seems to have a much higher mortality rate in that population, much, much higher. So what kinds of strategies are used to try to bring medical care to that population?
We have learned that the obstacles that people face when you're trying to find a bed for the night, your next meal, the obstacles to achieving health care and health care services are overwhelming. And that our programs have learned if you wait for people to come to you, to come to the traditional clinics or the traditional doctor's office, they don't do that because they're struggling with the rigors of surviving every day. So our programs, I think, have learned to reach out, to go to where people are, to meet them in places familiar to them, to set up enduring relationships on a one-to-one basis with people, and that then you use that relationship to parlay your health care service. And all across the country, in 188 different places, people have been trying to do this and coming up with some remarkable results. So I think the secret is in preventive care and in reaching out to make sure when people do become ill that you blanket them with services, acknowledging the overwhelming obstacles that living on the streets or in the shelters presents to them.
You mentioned that there were 188 sites across the country are providing services to the homeless. Are you describing the federal program? Because we have had a federal program for about 20 years, isn't that correct? And is that what's funding these projects?
Yes. So the federal program funds healthcare for the homeless projects around the country. They're in every state and Puerto Rico. The projects see about 650,000 different individuals each year. But since we know that there may be 3.5 million people, there are many people we're not seeing. Each project, of course, is unique. Some of them have outreach workers on vans, and Dr. O'Connell goes out, I think, every Monday night on a van and finds people in the street. Some of them have large freestanding clinics, as we do in Baltimore. We also do outreach, but we have a very nice large clinic. What is common to all of these projects, though, I think, is the notion of healthcare as democratic and participatory. We've learned in a very practical sense that we have to start where the client is, and that means starting geographically in the street, starting psychologically. And the client has to drive the kinds of health services that are accepted, otherwise they won't be effective.
What are the obstacles? Why would people not want to accept medical care? Is it because of mental illness, or they're afraid of what the costs might end up being for them? What are the obstacles?
Well, some of it's very practical. I was doing outreach one night and came upon this fellow who was living on a bus bench, and it was right across the street from a pharmacy. His feet were all wrapped up and extremely swollen, and he had a prescription in his pocket. And I looked at it and walked over to the pharmacy to try to fill it, and he said, "It's not going to work. I tried that myself." Well, in fact, he had been enrolled in a managed care program, a Medicaid managed care program, and they didn't have a contract with this pharmacist, so the pharmacist wouldn't fill the prescription. And no one had thought of this when he was in the hospital. And he didn't have money, of course, to pay out of pocket for a very expensive set of antibiotics. So there were several things we learned from this. One was it was the wrong prescription. He could have used less expensive antibiotics, and that you had to take fewer times a day, for example, rather than, you know, four times a day. Once a day is better if you're homeless. But also this issue of managed care and not having access to the pharmacy. All of these were barriers to getting health care.
Now, it must be fairly expensive to provide these services. For example, sending doctors out into places where homeless people may aggregate. I mean, I don't think there's anything saying that all homeless people are going necessarily to go to a specific location. So how do you find the clients who need treatment?
I think that's the challenge to all of us trying to care for homeless people. I think we have learned, certainly in Boston and in Baltimore and many cities that we're familiar with, that the population of chronically homeless people often tends to be more stable than we once thought. And a group of people who the outreach workers and teams going out to the streets get to know and become familiar with. And the possibilities then for setting up systems of care that can provide continuity and consistency from street corner right through the hospital into recovery programs. And so those things are possible, but it does require a coordinated team effort. I'd respond to the other part of your question, though, by saying I believe that the cost of sending doctors and nurse practitioners and all the allied health clinicians to the streets to engage people is probably minimal compared to the cost of not doing that, which results in people's care becoming done almost exclusively in very expensive emergency rooms, resulting in long delays in treatment, poor treatment regimens, and recurrent hospitalizations. And I think there are many studies across the country now that are looking precisely now at the economic impact, or as I would like to see it, the cost of us doing nothing for people out in the streets and in the shelters is actually very, very high. And I believe we're going to learn that it is going to be a very effective cost-saving maneuver, let alone improvement in health outcomes, et cetera, to get teams to break the traditional mode of waiting for people to come to them and go out and do, as so many cities have been trying to do, go out and engage people in a real system of care that's integrated into the mainstream, but begins by going out and learning, as Jeff said, a democratic way to engage people.
A number of basic public health pillars, you could say, all become problematic in this population. I was wondering if you can describe some strategies. For example, some of the biggest improvements in life expectancy in the U.S. actually occurred before there were hardly any effective medications, and that was during the first half of the 20th century when we separated our sewage from our drinking water supply. Well, this would seem to be a real problem for people who are homeless. How does that population deal with sanitation? And I assume there must be a big problem with illnesses brought on by lack of sanitation.
I work at Mass General Hospital, where we have a hospital-based primary care clinic that serves as one of the anchors for our outreach clinics. And we have seen repeatedly in the hospital people suffering from food poisoning when they have been eating their meals from dumpsters. And that usually occurs during the warm weather when things have been festering in the heat. And so we see, for example, salmonella poisoning relatively frequently, and it requires a hospitalization of 7 to 10 days at a cost of about $20,000 to $30,000. What we have done, I think, in many cities have done, is tried hard to adhere to good public health measures for keeping at least the shelters sanitary with good water, good food, proper management of food. And I think it's been a tribute to most cities that they have really done that well. So I would say that we see way less of the kind of illness we might have seen 50 or 75 years ago due to water. But I think that's been a huge effort by public health departments in the cities and states around the country.
At the same time, we're seeing a resurgence in some kinds of illnesses that were very uncommon for the last 40 or 50 years. For example, tuberculosis. There was very, very little tuberculosis until mass homelessness began occurring again, particularly in the late 80s and early 90s. Another one is trench foot, which, you know, had gone out with World War I, but now is seen fairly commonly among people who live on the streets and don't have access to clean socks and, you know, washing their feet and that sort of thing. All of this leads us to understand the very direct relationship between health and housing.
I would say one of the very interesting and profound experiences for me when I first left the hospital and started working in the shelter. So if you can imagine, I was a resident in charge of the intensive care unit at Mass General. People were flying from all over the world and all over the state to get care, and I had lots of machines I could dial in and felt I was managing very severe illnesses with some degree of expertise. And, you know, a week later, I was at the shelter clinic 6 blocks down the street with my first job as a doctor and feeling utterly overwhelmed and helpless. And I can remember one of the first people that was brought in to see me was a man who the shelter staff, not even clinically trained, said just didn't look very good. And I examined him, and he had been drinking a lot, was very thin, and looked to me like he just needed to stop smoking and stop drinking, and we could work on that, but I couldn't find any acute illness. His vital signs were normal. His exam was normal. And so I said to the shelter staff, let's keep our eye on him. If you think he's still doing badly, bring him in a couple of days. 2 days later, they brought him in and said, you know, doc, he just doesn't look right. And I'm still showing my feathers because I think I'm clinically very astute. And we did an x-ray, and it turned out he had extensive cavitary TB like I would only have seen in a third world country. And I realized, here's a man who's probably been living in a shelter of 700 people for the last 3 months with active tuberculosis. And it became the shock that when we were treating one person in the setting, you're actually treating 700. It was public. It was medicine smack in the face of public health. And what resulted after that was over the next year or so, we had 100 cases of active tuberculosis in that shelter, which was in the days just before AIDS and HIV had come into the homeless community, and it was multiple drug-resistant TB. It was kind of a foreshadowing of life ahead. And I've always thought that the irony is our city shelter here in Boston is on a beautiful island called Long Island, out just from the city. And the shelter was placed there because it was hard to find a community that would accept a 500-bed shelter. And the city had an empty building out on Long Island. And they decided to bus people out there each night and then bus them back in the morning. And the reason that building was empty is it was the former TB treatment facility for the city of Boston. And I think as you look at across the country, it's kind of an irony that many of our expert public health measures, which caused the emptying out of many of our treatment facilities, we've now filled them with homeless people. And what do we see? A recrudescence of tuberculosis and other communicable diseases that we had essentially wiped out.
If homeless individuals are in a shelter, it would seem that it would make it easier to get them treated medically because you could at least find them all in one place. If they're all scattered about, you wouldn't have that concentration of disease transmission, but you might also have a lot more difficulty finding the individuals.
I can speak from a very parochial point of view. In Boston, where I think, as Jeff said before, that every healthcare for the homeless program and anyone who's interested in caring for homeless people, you need to learn what the city dynamics are and the local geography, both politically and literally, and each program needs to respond to that community need. So in Boston, where we have a really elaborate system of adult and family shelters, the best service delivery model was to seize upon those shelters, to do clinics in the shelters where people do feel comfortable, tend to come relatively regularly, although with adult shelters in Boston, as in many cities, it's a first come, first serve, and people will wander around using different shelters depending on where the beds are available. But that network became the core of the clinic system, but they needed to be anchored by clinics run by the same folks in the hospitals, which was the mainstream of healthcare. And then the problem for us became those folks who didn't stay either wandered across different shelters or stayed outside. And the solution we had to come up with, and this took, you know, a lot of creative work on the part of our many partners around town, is to, as Jeff pointed out, we ride out on a van that goes out delivering soup and sandwiches every night of the week. We send our healthcare providers, I ride on Mondays and Wednesday nights, to go out and just become familiar with people living on the street. And which once looked chaotic to me, after 22 years of doing this, has almost an absolute rigid pattern. So we've learned in Boston, if you were to ask us where is so-and-so who lives on the street, it takes us usually about 45 minutes to find that person because we know where they usually stay and what their migrating pattern is during the day. And I've looked across the country and lots of cities have found very, very creative ways to begin to engage folks and continue to follow them. The other thing we had to realize is with so many entry points into the system, believe it or not, electronic medical records are absolutely critical for coordination of care for programs like ours. So we have to know that when someone walks into any one of our clinic sites, all of our clinicians are opening up the same record and entering live into that record. So wherever that person shows up next, the last medical intervention is clear and their allergies and medication list and what the active problems are right there. So I think you can find ways to do it, but I think the way I was trained in the hospital and in the clinic didn't allow me to do the kinds of things, nor was the reimbursement conducive to doing the kinds of things that we've learned are very effective in providing primary and preventive and continuing care to homeless people.
As Richard Nixon's budget director, Roy Ash, once said, budget is policy, though, and in 41 states, single adults who aren't completely disabled don't have access to Medicaid, to the major public health insurance program. And in those states, and Maryland is one of them, it's very difficult to get any reimbursement for the services we provide, and we're much more dependent upon any grants that we can get. So much of our time is spent writing grants and then monitoring the grants and sending reports to the funders, and it takes a large infrastructure to do all that, and of course all the money that's devoted to that administrative infrastructure doesn't go into providing direct health care services. So the budget in our case has created a system in which we have a central clinic, a large central clinic. We had 50,000 patient visits here last year, but that's the way we were forced to operate, in part because of the financing. Universal health insurance is not a complete solution, of course, to the delivery of health services, but it's a very important aspect of it. And then the affordable housing crisis, we wouldn't have to worry so much about the diseases caused by congregate living situations if people had their own homes.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. And our guests today are James O'Connell and Jeff Singer, both actively involved in the care of homeless Americans. After the break, we'll continue our look at the homeless population and discuss some policies that might improve the lives and the health of this population. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Today, Public Health Radio is looking at the health impacts of being homeless in the United States. Approximately 850,000 Americans are without shelter on any given night, at least 3.5 million each year. Every day and every night, they contend with exposure and the threat of violence, little access to quality medical care, nutrition, and the many other amenities of society most of us take for granted. Our guests, Jeff Singer, a social worker in Baltimore, and Dr. James O'Connell, an internist from Boston, have both worked with the homeless population throughout their careers. Earlier in the interview, Dr. O'Connell described a case of advanced drug-resistant tuberculosis that had infected the lungs of a homeless man who usually stayed in a large shelter in Boston. The man ended up infecting 100 other homeless individuals. Now back to the interview.
getting back to the case that Jim brought up a little earlier, you brought up the difficulty of getting patients their medications and then ensuring that they are actually able to take them, and the difficulty, for example, of a 4-times-a-day regimen of any medication. That's hard for anyone. But there are situations in which partial treatment of a patient's health problem could actually be harmful. And this is especially likely with antibiotic treatment. If you only take a few doses, maybe then feel a little better, you could select out resistant bacteria. And then if you do that, you may be left with an infection that's much harder to treat. And of course, with tuberculosis, that's the king of examples, where taking part of a tuberculosis treatment, those treatments often go on for months and months to be effective. Getting partial treatment not only could make the patient's tuberculosis case resistant to treatment, but then that has implications for the entire community. And in your case, Jim, you were talking about an entire shelter that was infected from a single individual with advanced tuberculosis. But then this issue of selecting out for resistant strains if the patient ends up partially treated, how do you deal with that kind of thing? And really, when the stakes are very high that a patient takes every dose, this chaotic life that homeless individuals are forced to live, how do you reconcile those two problems?
I think tuberculosis is the quintessential example of the public health dilemma that forces us as a society to address these issues. And I say that for these reasons. We do know, in fact, the index case for that outbreak of tuberculosis in a shelter in Boston back in the mid-80s turned out to be a man who had gotten tuberculosis back in the late 70s and had been only partially treated and escaped care. And what he did was breed out a resistant organism. It was resistant to both streptomycin and INH, isoniazid, two of the most common medicines used to treat tuberculosis. So then we were faced with exactly the dilemma you mentioned. We had 100 cases of active tuberculosis. Everybody needed 4 medications every day for 18 months, and we had to come up with a community-wide strategy from the state and the city departments of public health, from our clinics and the shelters themselves, to make sure we went out and found everybody every day to give them that medication. The cost of not doing that would be that we had active tuberculosis in the community, people riding the subways, people walking around downtown, and the public health nightmare scenario of this could be spread throughout the community. It would go from the shelter into the community. So there was compelling need to set up an infrastructure to do that. And I was overwhelmed by how well the city and the state and the community responded to that. And after 18 months, 96 of the 100 people had completely been treated. And there were 4 that were lost to follow-up who had simply left the state, and we do not know where they went. But I learned with that experience that when the desire is there, you can come up with systems to do it. The other disease that has been very difficult for us to handle, and we've been working for the last number of years from the time when the AIDS epidemic was just an early epidemic where we didn't even know what the organism was, to now when we can almost look at AIDS as a treatable chronic disease. But the treatment involves several medications, often several times a day, certainly in the beginning. I remember when AZT came out, it had to be taken every 4 hours around the clock. And I remember we used to have little alarms going off in the shelter all night where people were waking up to take their AZT, which horrified them because that identified them as someone who might have AIDS. But we had no choice. If we weren't doing that, people were going to be dying. And if they did it wrong, they could breed out resistance. So we've been challenged, I think, across the country with that, and we have found it's been gratifying. Around the country, people have set up systems of care where homeless people have done extremely well when offered the standard of care with a lot of the support. And I think I would also add to Jeff's, or underscore the importance of what Jeff is saying, is that we actually know how to treat these illnesses, and we know how to set up systems where people can be encouraged and helped to take their medications. But without the stability and safety of a regular place to live, that becomes immeasurably difficult. So I can remember Jeff knows as well, one of my first slides that I ever made because of my frustration at writing lots of antibiotic prescriptions and lots of other prescriptions, really, what I really was trying to do was write a prescription for a studio apartment to be used every day as directed for 30 days and refill it for 12 months. So the housing component becomes the absolutely necessary, but not always sufficient, but certainly the absolutely necessary component for health care and good outcomes.
As an internist, I spend a lot of my day encouraging patients to live what we call a healthier lifestyle. For example, eating a better diet and perhaps exercising. And I must say, thinking about the patients I've treated who've been homeless, just to give an example, personally, I can't imagine wanting to exercise if I can't take a shower afterward. It's sort of a basic thing. I don't, if you're homeless, I don't know where you would do that. I don't know where you would change your clothes if one set of clothes got sweaty. I can't imagine they're going to get good running shoes or whatever equipment they would need. I mean, just the obstacles to a simple statement like, you should get exercise, just seem enormous. And much the same thing for nutrition. If you're homeless, you can't put a vegetarian lasagna in the oven. It's not going to happen. So how do you begin to deal with those issues? We're told that lifestyle is so important, but here you're lacking even the most basic underpinnings that would allow for anything approaching even achieving that. How do you approach those issues?
We approach them very poorly because the lack of housing really prevents us from applying what I think we would all consider the standards of excellent care for many of the illnesses we treat. As you were speaking, Marvin, what I was thinking of is our patients who live with diabetes. And the standard treatment that we as physicians would say to people is that, you know, diet and exercise are the two pillars of treatment for diabetes. And when you think of the immediacy of living day to day on the streets, which first of all, makes looking toward tomorrow or the next day almost impossible. You're just trying to make it through today. So they don't have much choice in the diet. They will go to a shelter and whatever's being served, that's those are the calories you need that day. And most diets, as you know, in shelters tend to be exactly the wrong diet you want someone with diabetes to be using. And the other mainstay of care we have then is to treat with medication, insulin being, you know, the one that we rely on the most. But many shelters in many cities don't allow people to bring needles into the shelter. So you can't even prescribe insulin, which in many ways we've already shown to be one of the most effective ways to reduce costs and improve health outcomes down the line. So we struggle a lot with an chronic illness like diabetes about how do we bring hemoglobin A1Cs down so that we prevent strokes and heart attacks and kidney disease and eye complications. And I think healthcare for the homeless clinicians across the country would stand up in unison and say that we just can't do this without housing. We can really try, but we're working against almost impossible odds.
I would like to give you a quote from a government document that describes their program for healthcare for the homeless. And one thing I want to ask you in this question is, do you think that the government program that we have now that's been in existence for nearly 20 years, is that program adequate? Is it really reaching the majority of the homeless and really making a big difference? But let me just give you the quote from this the program's brochure. Here's the quote. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development reports 5 million extremely poor households in the U.S. who have to pay more than 50% of their income for housing or who live in severely substandard housing. And here's another part of the quote. In no U.S. jurisdiction, in no part of the United States, can a full-time worker earning minimum wage afford an apartment in their community at fair market rates. Now, it seems to me that you're both of you repeatedly emphasizing that all of these programs for the homeless really can't touch the problem and that the real prescription you want to write is not for amoxicillin, but it's for a home, for an apartment or some sort of shelter. How do you think in the U.S. we're going to address this when the rents and housing prices are so far out of reach to such a high proportion of our population.
By building a movement that turns popular attention to the crisis in housing, which has been hidden by, the last five administrations. It's a completely nonpartisan issue on both sides of the aisle. Affordable housing has been ignored. And we are part of groups of people who are building a movement to make housing part of the agenda again. The HUD budget today is about 40% of what it was 20 years ago.
That's housing and urban development federally.
Right. So federal support for affordable housing has declined to such an extent that 3.5 million people have no place to live, and 5 million people, as you suggested, are at risk of becoming homeless because they can't pay their rents. And in cities and suburbs throughout the country, there are millions of people who just don't have access to affordable housing. HUD, the federal government, and Department of Housing and Urban Development, and Congress have all abandoned their responsibility for this. On local levels, there's some movement. For example, housing trust funds. There are cities around the country that are adopting housing trust funds and finding some tax revenues to put into them to build and rehabilitate housing. Inclusionary zoning is increasingly popular as cities develop and large developments for expensive housing arise. Some cities are creating laws that require developers to include a small proportion of affordable housing, either at that site or to build it somewhere else, or at least to pay for it. So I think there's increasing national attention to this problem, and the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council is an active player in that movement.
I would look at the other side of your question as well and say that I think all of us recognize with some degree of horror that we are way downstream trying to take care of a problem that needs to be fixed far afield. And we are dealing with the consequences of failed policies and are trying hard to do the best we can. But
what you mean is that the effort to provide medical care to homeless people is overwhelming, and what really needs to happen is housing. Is that what you're getting
at? And it's so hard in my clinical world to get my hands around how I could prevent what's going on. What we are is overwhelmed by the consequences of whatever those failed policies. And I think I would expand what Jeff is saying to say it's not only housing, but it's failure in education, in labor, in agriculture, in corrections, in our schools, etc. All of those sectors of society, whenever there are failures, I think what you see is you see the consequence of that in the collection of people who are forced to struggle without homes because of these overwhelming problems. I think what we would all love to see is that I wish I could be caring for people who are still in their housing so we can prevent them from having to suffer the consequences of homelessness. That said, I think what is another movement that's going on right now is the realization the moral argument we've been making seems to fall on deaf ears, or at least hardened ears. What seems to emerge, though, is that there's an economic argument now, that there is a cost to a failed housing policy, and that's that you have literally millions of people on the streets of our cities, in our suburbs and rural areas, and that those are people who are suffering horrible health outcomes, which result in very costly utilization of our most expensive services. So our emergency rooms are teeming in every big city. In fact, the overcrowding in emergency rooms has reached a national crisis level. In Boston, when we ask each of our hospitals of the 25 highest utilizers of your emergency room, how many are homeless, it's been a staggering anywhere from 40 to 80% of those people are people who are homeless. And then when you look at what happens when people get admitted to the hospital who are homeless, they end up having more severe problems complicated by many other things, including substance abuse and mental health, and it results in prolonged lengths of stay and poor discharge planning because there's no safe place to discharge someone. So I think as we start to assess what the cost is of not doing anything, and that cost, of course, is shifted down into the medical and substance abuse and mental health system away from the housing system, that we'll start to get some balance again. But I think it's going to need a really concerted movement to not only get the data, but to look at the cost-effective ways of doing it and to make sure that there's a national awareness of what's going on.
This is fairly horrifying to listen to the stories you've told. And what would you like the listeners to do?
I think if people could begin to just pay attention to what's going on, to look beyond the everyday and see the lives of the people who are suffering, our neighbors in all of our cities who are suffering by living in shelters and on the streets, and start to realize that there's always a very compelling and almost always a very courageous story behind the life of that person who now seems to be numb to us or blinded to us. And then I think people would start to become aware of the solution to this problem is going to require just about every sector of society to look at the issues of poverty and how we start to work better together, that you can't fund medical care separately from mental health care, separately from other care, and that people who are in jails can't be discharged without a careful discharge plan and some job experience. All of these things begin to paint a picture of a society that starts to pay attention to the poorest and most vulnerable among us. And it's going to save us money, it will make us happier, and actually it is something that we should be doing. The problem I have seen is that it's just so hard. We get so overwhelmed by the complexity of the problem and the multiple dimensions, as you hear Jeff and I mentioning today, that people begin to drop back and say, oh, there's nothing I can do. And I don't believe that at all. I think there's tons we can do to begin to get all of these various sectors working better together. There's two things that have been really eating away at us more recently as we're looking what to do. And this is all in the context of how do you deliver good health care when people are still homeless. Around the country, there's been a growing movement to recognize that as the healthcare system has migrated the acute care from inpatient hospitals to homes, homeless people have suffered inordinately. And the example I would give you is that in 1985, when I was finishing my residency and starting this job, if you had a hernia surgery to be done, you would be admitted to the hospital the day before, have your anesthesia pre-op and your medical pre-op, have your surgery the next day, and stay in the hospital 4 to 5 days until you're up and walking around and moving your bowels and doing all the things that we would know made sense to fix a hernia. Now that surgery is done as day surgery. Somebody has to bring you to the hospital in the morning and pick you up in the afternoon, and all the care is done at home. If you have no home, what do? Gallbladder surgery, hernia surgery, knee surgery, most orthopedic surgery now is all day surgery. The other thing that happened, if you were admitted for a coronary artery bypass surgery, the most common surgery done, the average length of stay in the hospital back in 1985 was close to 3 weeks and sometimes 4 weeks, and now it's 3.5 days. And so the care that was once given in hospitals is now given in the homes with a lot of support, and homeless people throughout the country have just suffered terribly. They're not getting surgery because they don't have someone to pick them up and take care of them in the pre- and post-op setting. We used to do chemotherapy and radiation in the hospital. Now that's done as an outpatient. So imagine you're sick with cancer and struggling with a potentially fatal illness. You have to have your chemotherapy, which makes you feel exhausted, but you go to the hospital and have to leave in the afternoon after your infusion. Where do you go? So the response that many cities have done around the country is to try to set up programs that can care for homeless people who are in these particularly difficult healthcare situations. And these have traditionally been called respite care programs. There are some 30 to 40 cities who are developing these. We have not yet been able to convince the system that this is an important new addition to the continuum of care necessary to care for vulnerable populations. So we were able in Massachusetts to get Medicaid to actually pay for a service like that based on our ability to show that it was saving the hospital's money by shortening lengths of stay and preventing people from having to be admitted for surgery. And I think that kind of creative thinking is something that's necessary at the federal level, so that's available to homeless people throughout the country. And that's one of the concerns I have. The second one is just dealing with some of the data that we are trying to cope with. And we've been frustrated by not knowing what happens to people, for example, who live out in the streets for years. And we all know them. They're the people that show up on the front page of the papers. When there are deaths on the street, those are the ones that seem to get the attention of both the newspapers and the media. But we don't really know the natural history, what happens when we let people out there. So we've tried now for about 7 years in Boston to follow a group of about half the people who have chronically lived out in the streets. And to our horror, we found out that a small group of 119 people over the five-year period had 18,000 emergency room visits in our city, which staggered all of us and captured the attention of all of our hospitals. But then when we've been following the mortality data on this population, this is a group who, after 7 years, half of them, despite their age of in the mid-40s, are now dead or in nursing homes. So here's a group of people that are visible to all of us walking through our urban cities, that are using our emergency rooms at astronomically high rates at costs that are beyond belief, and yet our outcome is the worst mortality rates of any subpopulation in America. So if ever there was a boring in of what's the problem, here is it. How can we not but come up with some better solution to deal with the folks who are coming into our emergency rooms but for whom we have so little treatment options and terrible follow-up and horrible and embarrassing outcomes?
And the sequel to the last part of that is that there's a model that has been the dominant model in homeless services following the budget for homeless, which is there's this continuum of care in which people have to prove that they're worthy to stay in an emergency shelter, and then they prove that they're worthy to stay in transitional shelter, and then they prove they're worthy to stay in transitional housing, and if they're really lucky, they get one of the few affordable housing units around. And we've seen that that doesn't work too well, particularly for people who are the most ill, people who have comorbidities, the, you know, diabetes and mental illness and an addiction. Well, to counterpose a new model, housing first, for decades, many of us have informally just tried to get people off the streets and into an apartment because they wouldn't or couldn't go to a shelter. And once they're in an apartment, if we provide them with enough supportive services, they usually stayed in the apartment, and in fact, they got better because it was easier to treat any of their problems. Well, about 3 years ago, the federal government had an Archimedean experience, Eureka. There is a solution to homelessness, and it's to make sure people have housing. They call it Housing First. It's a nationally funded initiative, but at a very, very small level. Nonetheless, cities all over the country are proving that you can help people get right off the street into their own apartment with a lot of supportive services, and they'll probably stay housed, and their health measures will probably improve. Their use of emergency rooms will decrease dramatically if people have merely access to affordable housing and supportive services. So we're promoting that model now and trying to create adequate budgets for it, and that's an important way to address the problems that Jim mentioned.
This really sounds like something that's like too hard to understand, that helping someone who's homeless by getting them a home. I don't know if the listeners or the government can be expected to follow that. At any rate, Jim O'Connell and Jeff Singer, I'd like to thank you both so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
It's been our pleasure.
It has been a total pleasure. Thank you so much, Mark.
Listeners who'd like more information on the public health impacts of homelessness are encouraged to access the website of the National Healthcare for the Homeless Council, nhchc.org, which has a great deal of useful information and links to many other relevant websites. That's nhchc.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.